Welcome to Nui Tech People, episode 27. Today we've got Martin Carr. Martin has one of the more exciting tech jobs in Newcastle. So he works on virtual simulations, building simulations for the Defence Force. Really interesting to hear sort of what their business does, how it came about, and Martin's take on building those software teams. I hope you enjoy this episode. Episode 27 of Nui Tech People. Today we've got Martin Carr, Director of Applied Virtual Simulations. Welcome, Martin.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Mate, you are a definite hidden gem in the Newcastle scene. I've talked to a few people about this podcast going to happen, and people are overwhelmed about what you guys do and that they didn't even know you exist. So for the people that don't know, who are you? What do you guys do?
My name's Martin, Director of Applied Virtual Simulation. We are, strictly speaking, a defense systems integrator. Practically what we do is we build training systems for defense applications, primarily. Basically simulators, hardware, software, integration through to training support, having guys on the ground. So essentially we design and build tools for delivering training to soldiers.
I had the pleasure of coming out and visiting your little workspace, or not even little, significant size workspace a week ago. Got to sit in the little van and drive that around. It was an experience that I didn't know existed in Newcastle. Crazy that you're actually rolling that training out to defence. How did that come about?
Pretty organically, I would say. So my background, background in the military. I was an officer in the Australian Army. Did about 10 years, principally as a reservist. And that obviously gave me insight into how the military trains, how they make use of technology, the challenges, particularly as a reservist, you tend not to get access to the same training capabilities as the full-time army. I'm also a gamer. I've been playing games forever. And the sort of two intertwined when I discovered that the Army had some game-based simulation technology. I grabbed a license and I'm not technically trained, so I started hacking away at it and started building little training vignettes for my trainees. I was an instructor at that stage. I kept the company informed that made the software, Bohemia Interactive, and I know you've had Ryan Stevenson.
Yeah.
Hello, Ryan.
on before. Kept them informed, and one day they offered me a job as a business developer. So I went, moved up here or up to Port Stevens, as it was based at the time, and spent about 5 years working for Bohemia Interactive Simulations, running the business development arm for Asia Pacific region. So basically from Japan to New Zealand.
Nice.
Yeah, and that gave me the opportunity to travel around and see how a lot of different militaries train, different levels of technology, different levels of doctrine, different approaches. Then after sort of 3 years, I decided I wanted to sort of see how the sausage got made. So yeah. I went from the business side of the company to the development side, and I was a product owner for a IR&D project for about 12 months. That was over in the UK. That project didn't meet its potential, I guess. Ran it for about 12 months. It was about 2 years into development at that stage. Ran it for 12 months, and then essentially it was put on the back burner, team dispersed, and I came back to Australia. Did a little bit more business development, but I sort of caught the bug of making things, and left Bohemia Interactive in 2016 to form Applied Virtual Simulation, and started building the kinds of systems that I would have wanted when I was an officer in the Army, and that's sort of my approach to working out what to build.
Yeah, it's one of those sort of startup success stories where somebody, it's come out of scratching your own itch. You obviously, you said you were training other people in the army or in the reserves, and you had, hey, we could be doing this better, and then you've built products around that. So as somebody that's actually got some real insight into a problem or something can be done better, and then you're going ahead and building on the back of that, right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. Simply design the products that I would have wanted to have. And as well, we were seeing a need arise, you know, from Army wanting to adopt simulation more, you know, sort of directive that came down from sort of the Chief of Army, you know, all the way down through the organization to increase the utilization of simulation. And I guess that's one of the observations I'd make working with defense as opposed to working with civil companies, businesses. The military tends to see things through. You know, they tend to have, you know, top-down intent, which filters through all the, you know, from the very top down. And when they say they're going to do something, they tend to see it through over successive years and even, you know, surviving posting cycle, you know, new people.
Yeah.
That intent carries through. So I saw the market would be getting bigger, essentially.
Yeah.
As this directive came out to increase the use of simulation, and decided to jump on it.
Yeah, mate. So when we caught up before, and you were showing me around all the gear, you were talking to me about the benefits of simulation, right? So as opposed to taking X amount of people out in the field and running training regimes, the benefits of doing it in a simulation environment. Can you just sort of elaborate on that for the listeners that haven't heard that?
Yeah, so the type of simulators we develop are tactical trainers in the sense that you get in the simulator and you, for want of a better term, you play a game, you know, you run through a scenario, and the training objective is cognitive training, decision-making, communications, working in a group, you know, solving a tactical problem in a practical way. Most people that are familiar with simulation might be familiar with like flight simulators, and you know, and our systems kind of differ because flight simulators are designed to teach you how to do a thing, you know, how to operate a piece of equipment, you know, whereas our simulators are on the sort of higher level. So we focus on those tactical cognitive tasks, which tend to be quite difficult to do in a live training environment. And they're difficult because of the degree of complexity in the training. You need, you know, your whole team out there. So you need lots of vehicles, you need lots of resources, you know, particularly if you're doing combat oriented training. You need ammunition, you need all the safety considerations that go along with it. You are vulnerable to environmental conditions. You know, you get the conditions that you get when you go out on the range. That might mean you can't fire because it's too hot. You know, that's a perennial issue with the Australian Army. It gets too hot to even fire blank ammunition in the field. You know, or you can't use the range at nighttime if you know, ranges that are close to residential areas tend to have considerations on where you can operate. So nighttime training is out. You know, so in the simulator, they can jump in. We can create very complex tactical scenarios that would be very complex, very expensive, very dangerous to do in real life. And yeah, we see it as an enhancement to the live training. There is sort of line of thinking that simulation is used to take away from live training. It's a cost reduction measure.
Yeah.
And a lot of the sort of marketing of simulation is, yeah, this will save you money, this will save you money,
yeah,
you know. And that can be very, well, particularly to the soldiers and the instructors, you know, that's a pretty unpopular idea that, hey,
we're doing this because it's just saving money.
We're saving money and we're going to cut your field time. Mm.
Yeah,
you know, we're actually going to take away stuff, you know, and we're going to give you this simulator as a replacement for cutting your training out field. Whereas we say that, well, no, this is actually more expensive because we want you to continue to do the live training and also do this simulation-based training in the lead up to the live training.
Yeah, because you mentioned there's some benefits to it as well, as opposed to live training when you're out there and you've got to retrospectively look at what happened, you can actually, in your virtual environment, you can stop it right there, talk about something in the real time, what's happened here, what's happened there, and provide people more real-time feedback, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, particularly when you're doing combat training, whether you're dismounted, you know, on your feet, running around,
yeah,
or you're in vehicles, confusion is really the main factor that you're trying to sort of overcome, because you know, if you've got vehicles spread out everywhere, that's shouting, that's firing, you know, you may be out of where the action is and you can't see or hear what's going on. So a lot of the time, you know, particularly again combat training, a couple of guys will be in the fight, so to speak, and everybody else will be kind of, you know, doing their job, looking around, but not seeing what's going on. So yeah, in the simulator we can you know, with the replay functionality, stop, get everybody out of the simulator, we can rewind, we can replay the scenario from the perspective of any, you know, crew member, or from, you know, God's eye view, or from the enemy's view, you know, whatever brings out the best training points, and that way the entire trainee cohort is learning the lessons that, you know, only that lead guy, you know, would have learned. So yeah, I think in many ways it's superior to conventional field training. But yeah, certainly not a replacement for it. No, I keep coming back to that because...
Yeah, that's... Well, as you said, you know your spot in the market, right? You come from that background. You're not trying to replace something. It's in conjunction with.
Yeah.
It's in addition to.
Yeah, we're trying to enhance.
Yeah, yeah, as opposed to take something away, right? And when you look at it from that perspective, it's some massive benefits there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's why we've been quite successful, because our, you know, we see this is an enhancement to the live training that you're currently doing, and the instructors and the trainees, you know, when they use the simulator, they get that, and they're like, no, this is, you know, this is not just a cost saving measure. This is actually something that makes us better as soldiers. So, yeah,
I like it. Yeah. I like it, and I like the fact that you're obviously building it with that background. So you know who you're building it for. You know that it is, you know, a proper value add, as opposed to, let's say, just pure game developers trying to replicate what's going on in the field. You actually come with
that. Yeah, right? Yeah. I don't know how. I wouldn't know how to suggest to, you know, anyone who's outside of defense, you know, how to develop products for defense. I think it's very difficult. And similarly, like we don't do a lot of work outside of, you know, a narrow lane of expertise, right? Because I have no idea, you know, how to go into, you know, a mining company and say, hey, this is how this simulator is going to, you know, train your guys.
Stay in your lane, right?
Well, yeah, I think you got to do what you know. But saying that, you need to be vigilant that you might not, you don't know everything, right? So our approach is we work very, very closely with our end users, the instructors. You know, the way our systems are procured is very different to conventional military contracting. You know, conventional military contracting, you know, you have a project office. They, you know, do a market survey. They speak to subject matter experts, and then they come up with a big list of requirements. Yeah, simulator must have this, must have that, you know, must have these things, shall not, and they put that out to market and say, yeah, here's it, here's a contract, here's the requirements, vendors, tender, all right, which is fine if you're trying to procure something that kind of already exists and something that has well-defined, you know, criteria. But if you're looking at doing something kind of innovative, it's, you know, I think to some degree it's impossible to use that approach to try and go out and ask people, because you know, how can you draft the requirements of something that doesn't exist? And then if you make assumptions about the requirements, you know, are they right?
Yeah, yeah. How do we change that?
Yeah, so we deliver a system and in a sort of prototype phase, we work with the instructors, we work with the trainees, any good ideas get thrown into a backlog, and you know, we work with our customers to prioritize the features they want. So a lot of parts of our simulators are good ideas that have come from instructors or soldiers, and not just my over the top top down kind of design.
Yeah, nice. You don't come from a tech background, and you're now running what is essentially a technology business, right?
Yeah.
How did you make that? How did you get into technology? How did you make that leap?
Mainly just hacking around things myself. Working at Bohemia, I got opportunity to be around engineers, developers, scrum masters, product owners, those kind of guys to see how they work. And then a lot of, in my own time, learning to script, learning to modify a simulation environment, and then later learning sort of the electrical engineering part, learning to solder, learning how to build PCBs, and then how to integrate hardware and software. So it's self-taught, which means it's sort of painful and laborious and inefficient. That's how I kind of developed my technical chops, which is maybe not necessarily what I recommend. Found myself running a tech company. Interesting.
Which is interesting. And you mentioned a broad range of skills there, right? You've got some super high-tech software and you've built in with some hardware. Like, for the people that haven't seen, let's say, one of the vehicles,
mm-hmm.
give somebody a quick overview of like what's it involved? Because I know you use another Newcastle company with the design of the vehicles to make sure it does replicate what looks like in the field and what the experiences are like for the trainees.
Yep.
And then you tie that into the software and it all integrates together. For the people that haven't seen it, give us a quick overview because it is so, there's such a breadth of
involved. Sure. Well, I guess we'll talk about the protected mobility tactical trainer and we'll give you some videos and some images and stuff that we can put on the website so that guys can actually see what it physically looks like.
But 100%.
The brief was Army School of Transport based down at Tobruk Barracks, Pakapunyal. They train all of the Army's, large part of the Army's drivers. They also train logistical core of transport, junior leaders, corporals, basically the sort of most junior management, the most junior rank that they would expect, to go out in the battle space and lead a group of trucks to do a task. So they run, a corporal will lead between maybe 4 and 6 trucks. Okay. So we need to develop a training system that allows them to have 4 to 6 trucks and go out in a virtual battle space and conduct a mission. So from there, we work out, we need to build some truck cabins. So we talk to some local fabricators, Design Anthology.
Hello, Josh.
They do the hardware design. So we build a sort of mock-up of the vehicle cabin. That will include a crew compartment for the driver and co-driver, a cupola, which the gunner sits in. So you can imagine big metal boxes. We put the driver and co-driver station on a motion platform so that when they're driving along, they get bumped and jostled around. It's not a, you think motion platform, you think like big, massive flight sim, huge thing in a warehouse. No, this thing's sort of only a little bit bigger than a regular vehicle cabin. We build a forward view array, which can be done with projectors or with, in our case, we use, or in this particular case, we use 64-inch curved monitors,
three of them.
Yeah. So the driver and co-driver share a big sort of front view array, which gives them about the same field of view as they'd have in real life. The gunner in the back, obviously, he can look in all directions. So he's got a head-mounted display that he wears, integrated in with his helmet, with his communications equipment. He's got a replica machine gun that we put on a swiveling mount, so he can orientate machine gun in any direction. He can fire. He can operate the safety catch, things like that. So that's the sort of physical hardware build. And then you've got sort of 5 of these vehicle cabins all together in one room. Then on the electronics side, driver, co-driver, gunner, they all are wearing a communications headset, straight USB device. They've got various other USB devices, you know, the machine gun, USB machine gun, you know, which runs off Arduinos.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm sure anyone who's in tech's familiar with simple little Arduinos that we hook up to the trigger and the safety catch and the swiveling mount. We use SteamVR Lighthouse tracking for the gunner. So he has 6 degree of freedom movement. And that just runs through a plugin which communicates the position to the virtual environment. We use an off-the-shelf virtual environment, VBS3, which is made by Bohemia, my former employer. And then in there we script the scenario. So we put all the vehicles down, we play some enemy. It's all sort of drag and drop, WYSIWYG kind of mission creator.
Yeah.
If anyone's familiar with the Arma series of games, Arma and VBS3 have a common ancestor, is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
So people that are familiar with realistic shooter games like Arma will be very familiar with VBS3. And we create a mission, and then we have a whole bunch of other applications that run in the background. They handle communications, the mission recorder that records what's going on. So there's metal bending, there's API, C++, plugin development, DLL development, there's soldering, there's wiring things up, there's installing lighthouses, there's vinyl wrapping the vehicle so they've got a cool camouflage print, there's installing touchscreens. So it's a real wide range of different skills.
That's massive, man.
And then we build them and install them, and then we run them. So our guys will go down there and administer the system, make sure it runs good, and make sure any crashes are dealt with and everything works. So
I was shocked to say it. I just couldn't believe that something like this was sitting locally that no one knew about. So I think it's a really cool story. Mate, you talked about the sort of the game development and the sort of the game, your individual gaming background. I think from a software perspective, there's a lot of people going through university at the moment who grew up gamers, who would love to become game developers.
Yep.
I'd call, I don't know with 100% certainty, but I would say you're of a handful at tops game development companies or game elements of game development companies in Newcastle. How have you found that? Has it been easy to find people that have got the skills that can do that? How have you found building out a team that can work with those technologies?
We've recruited almost exclusively from University of Newcastle. We've hired a number of comp sci software engineering graduates. Had fantastic results. Got an awesome team of really dedicated, capable engineers. We're one of the few companies in Newcastle that offers so anything like game development. Recruiting for us it's a crucial part of a small business. We the engineers we have, we invest a lot of time and effort into enabling them to develop their skills, and then because what we do is so niche, the tools we work with, it's difficult for us to sort of hire, I guess, senior developers, because there's just simply no people with experience with these particular virtual environments and stuff. But because the virtual environment we work with most often, VBS3, has Arma, we actually can take guys that are experienced game modders, and their skills are actually very transferable to the military. So we're lucky in that regard.
Yeah, so that sounds props to Newcastle University for being able to turn out some really solid graduates, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And for people that are currently at university who have an interest in either game development or something very close to actually getting some employability with game development, which is a bigger challenge than game development itself. You mentioned some other avenues if they've got some experience with Arma. What other pieces of advice would you give to somebody that would want to get into a team like yours?
Yeah, so we're above all, we look for attitude, more so than any specific skill set. or specific experience, because you know, as an undergrad, you don't really have any experience. It's, you know, we look for, yeah, attitude, willingness to learn, you know, willingness to stick with it. Things like personal side projects do matter. If you're, you know, doing a degree, or even not, you know, if you're at TAFE, or even if you're completely, you know, not pursuing tertiary education, but you're modding a game, right? That kind of stuff, you know, we look at. And even, you know, with your personal projects, demonstrating that you can see them through and finish them, you know, a finished project is indicative of a degree of conscientiousness,
yeah,
which is, you know, would make someone like me pay attention, you know,
yeah,
regardless of the quality, if you stuck through and finished it.
Yeah,
you know, that's so important.
Yeah, mate, I think we're talking super technical skills here, right? Like, you know, development in that game, like it's super technical, yet you're still somebody that hires for attitude. I think it's so common now throughout technology. It doesn't matter how technical the role is. A lot of skills can be taught or learned if you've got the right attitude, if you've got somebody like that. The other part that I really love is that side projects. I'm like, especially for graduates or somebody that doesn't have a heap of experience, mate, side projects, if it's somebody that's got a genuine interest in it, or can see things through, or can do something in their own time.
Yeah.
It is the biggest differentiator.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it demonstrates, that you can see things through. Also demonstrates that you can actually estimate whether or not a project is within your capabilities.
Yeah.
You can have side projects, and I'm so guilty of, I mean, come and have a look at my shed. I'm extremely guilty of starting side projects, you know, that sort of get halfway done. But yeah, an ability to sort of estimate, hey, can I take this on, and can I get something finished? Yeah, even if it's just like a simple little Unity game or whatever it is, you know, I think that demonstrates the kind of things that at least I find really desirable in a candidate.
Yeah, cool. So if somebody's at university at the moment or building a game in Unity on the side at the moment, we'll put your contact details in there on our show notes page, but
yeah,
it's probably worth a shout.
Send me your projects. Send me your finished projects.
Yeah.
Finished projects.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Yeah. And it is. It's not easy building a team with that specific skill set, but going at it from that perspective, from the ground up, bringing people with the right attitude, a bit of skill, and teaching them, it's a great opportunity for people to stay local in Newcastle and do something. Really cool.
Yeah, I hope we're giving good opportunities. I don't see many companies. I mean, saying that, one of the strengths of Newcastle is in the particular niche that we operate in, you know, military simulation for land-based applications. Actually, Newcastle's almost the center of gravity in Australia for this, and that's principally because, you know, there's three companies in the region that really invented the market segment. One that invented it, and two other companies. So, yeah, surprisingly enough, and you know, you've had Bohemia here and Virtual Simulation Systems. Yeah, it's really a center of gravity in the country.
Yeah, that's really nice. So on that note, for Newcastle, right, you were in Port Stephens for a while with Bohemia, and then you've decided to build your business in Newcastle. Is it on the back of that? As you said, it is sort of your centre here, the proximity to defence. Is that why you chose Newcastle?
Yeah, well, it was a matter of moving up. I'm from Canberra, from Canberra originally. So we moved up to Port Stephens, with Bohemia, moved to Newcastle, look, Newcastle's fantastic. You know, it's a great place to start a business. You know, like this, you know, there are, you know, it's got everything that you would need, you know, and I think its size is a strength, because it's a big enough city that, yeah, we have everything we need, you know, in the sense that we have, design anthology that does, you know, industrial design and all the hardware and you know, the sort of hardware aspects of the product development. You know, there is Uon, which puts out really good, you know, comp sci software engineering graduates. You know, there's Core Electronics, the electronics supplier. So there's enough, you know, without them being 2 hours away.
Yeah.
You know, so in a day, you know, we can drive around Newcastle, visit, you know, almost all of our suppliers. And I think that's a real strength when you look at why you would start a company in Newcastle as opposed to somewhere like Sydney or Melbourne, where, yeah, your talent pool is much bigger and there are much, you know, many more companies, but, you know, they're all spread out across a large metropolitan,
yeah,
an outlying area. So it's actually much less practical to,
yeah,
to go and have those meetings with your suppliers and stuff. So that's an important factor too.
I agree. Is there any challenges that you've faced in Newcastle?
Not really. I mean, I love Newcastle.
It does seem like a perfect sweet spot for you guys, for your company in particular. Proximity to the other company's suppliers, good talent pool coming through the university. It does seem like, I imagine, you know, your rent for your warehouse or your space is, you know, you don't have a small space. You're not looking at a small office space, and it's affordable in Newcastle as opposed to a major city.
Right? Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we're still sort of in a suburbs, yeah. And yeah, it's affordable. It's great.
Yeah, mate, I think you're sort of the perfect scenario, perfect sort of company for that growth. And it's good to see some success and growth, as you said, like your team members are growing year on year. So it's a good, legit success story for Newcastle. Mate, and on that note, so the Newcastle tech scene, you've been around for a while now. You've seen some growth. You're relatively well connected with other people in the market. What's your take on what you've seen in the tech scene in Newcastle?
Well, we're probably not as connected as some of your other guests. Yeah, as you mentioned, not many people know about us, and that's to a certain degree intentional. We have no customers here.
Yeah.
We don't market locally, but we do make connections. I know a lot of the team attends a lot of the events, you know, IGDAs, talks, you know, meetups, and things of that nature. Fortunate enough to know a bunch of guys like, you know, Andy, who runs VRXP, Dave and Josh from Mudbath, through those guys, you know, you kind of get exposed to, you know, the local scene. I think we're a little bit of an outsider. I didn't have a big tech network, so yeah, it's just kind of meeting those guys and meeting their colleagues and friends and stuff kind of grows from there. But it certainly seems like it, you know, does have a vibrant tech scene in a lot of different domains.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a key part of that different domains thing. I think you guys are in a spot that, you know, a niche that not a lot of people know about. So it's good to sort of, and that's one of the objectives of this podcast, is trying to unearth that and share those stories, because Newcastle has a definite growing tech scene, and there's a lot of it that's not known about. You've got a team of engineers there that didn't exist in Newcastle, you know, 5 years ago, and that's continuing to grow, put out technology that's being used, you know, by Defence Forces nationally.
It's super, super happy that it's that it's kind of worked out. It's always a risky proposition starting a small business. The survival rates are pretty average.
Yeah, they are.
and we have been able to grow a small team here, and really kind of realize my vision for the company, which is to, you know, have just a small team of guys and you know, do really sort of innovative work.
Yeah, on that note, on a small team, you mentioned the word small. Is there objectives to grow bigger to a, is it, do you have a number in mind? I think you've got some thoughts around, you know, particular team sizes and running optimally.
I think for my part, I think AVS, we're sort of eight to nine staff at the moment. And that's really as big as I ever envisioned wanting to get. I like, operating with a small team. I think sort of 8 to 10 is an ideal small team size. I mean, maybe 10 might even be slightly too big. In my limited experience, I've noticed that there tends to be pinch points as companies grow. One is sort of at 8 to 10 staff members. The next one's kind of 30 to 50. And then the next one is sort of when you get a 100 to 150, you know, as you transition larger. And I know I was at Bohemia Interactive when they sort of broke through that upper pain point at the sort of 100 to 150 staff. And
yeah.
I think it got up to about 220 when I was during my time there. And one thing I observe is that these correspond, and I'm not obviously the only one that has observed these kind of correspond to the natural sizes of military units.
Yeah, right.
So the smallest team size in a military, particularly in an army context, is a section. And they're sort of 8 to 10 soldiers. And then the next one is a platoon, and that's kind of 25 to 35 soldiers, you know, depending on the type of platoon it is or troop. And then you know, get up to the sort of company level, which is between 90 and 160. Yeah. So I think we see these kind of natural group sizes, and I'd be curious, you know, if similar things exist in, you know, the medical profession, say, or in research or something like that, where you kind of get these natural team sizes, and I think it's a function of how close and intimate you can get with, you know, a certain number of people, you know. Yeah. When there's sort of you and six or seven others, to go in the army context, you know what pocket that guy keeps his first aid kit in.
Yeah.
You know that Smitty gets angry when he's tired. You know, yeah. You know where this, who's got the spare toilet roll. You know, like,
yeah.
you know very intimately, and you can just, if someone's down, you can pick up the slack and carry them if they're sick or whatever, and you know intimately what everybody's doing and what they're supposed to be doing. So yeah. Once you get above that size, I think it's just not possible. And then again, when you get up to sort of 30, kind of three groups of eight, you know, you know everybody, but you don't necessarily know them intimately. Yeah. You know,
you don't know the dog's name, and you don't know their
ins
and outs.
Yeah, you don't know that they've got a sick mum, so they, you know, so you kind of, those things that, you know, in your little group of six or seven guys, you know, Schmitty gets angry when he's tired.
Yeah.
You know, it's 30 guys, you're like, oh, he's just an angry asshole. You know? Yeah. Because he's just tired. Or, he's always late because his mum's sick, or whatever. In that group, it's like, oh, he's always late because he's a slacker. You know? Yeah. And you get sort of a bit of factionalization and stuff, and which needs to be sort of regulated through processes. And, you know, and then at the company level, company in the military company, or in a large organization where you've got 100 people, you don't know even their names, right?
Yeah. That's a really good point. I'd never heard of it. I don't have that knowledge of the military, so I don't know how it's broken down. It's the first time I heard that. It's super interesting. And it makes sense.
Yeah, I should rightfully credit the first place I heard that kind of analogy, who raised it first, but I'm sure it was some military thinker or some academic that looked at group sizes and optimizing group sizes and things like that. And so it doesn't matter what you're doing.
Yeah.
It seems humans
have
these natural group sizes that they are, you know, they work best in.
Oh, nice, man. Nice. Hey, breaking teams down to you individually for a sec. You now went from your background and now running a team of, you know, it's close to 10 people.
Yeah.
How do you run your day? You're running multiple, you're project managing, you're team managing, you're people managing, you're selling, you're BDing, you're doing all this. What's from a productivity perspective, how do you operate? Is there a productivity tool that you use?
Well, I should, I certainly have a productivity tool. It's my CTO, Craig Williams. Hello, Craig. That's a bit rude calling him a productivity tool. No, but yeah, so in the first couple of years starting everything, I mean, I started as a one-man show. I did everything. Yep. I did everything poorly.
Yeah,
and I remain an amateur in a wide range of areas professionally. Now we have structure. We have a CTO who's supremely experienced in running teams and building software.
He's definitely got some strengths there. He's
absolutely. So, so I've been able to bring that structure in and run it. So I don't take so much of a role in the day-to-day development, you know, in terms of grooming the backlog,
yep.
planning sprints, that kind of stuff. Speaking specifically about tools, we run Slack because I think ASIC fines you now if you don't run Slack. Slack obviously is ubiquitous. It's super useful. Jira, again, we're a software company. People will laugh at you if you don't use Atlassian products. Personally, Todoist.
Yeah.
Just a, to-do checklist. Mm-hmm. That's how I keep myself focused, mm-hmm. by, fulfilling a list of tasks, prioritizing and just smashing through them. I've been accused in the past of being disorganized and having a pretty chaotic style.
I could put myself in that bracket.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people, I'm sure everybody's system looks like chaos to the outsider.
That's whether it's organized chaos.
Everybody, yeah. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with having 1,200 unread emails, right? we got a system here. I don't use a lot of productivity tools except for
You say that, but Todoist. You do, right? Like, Todoist, like even the fact that you work off Fliss, right? That's your go-to. It sounds like that's a productivity tool in itself, and it's a method, and it's obviously a method you found work for you. And then the secondary part is, it sounds like you've also become quite good from a delegation perspective. You your role or your company is now at a size where you've brought in a strong CTO to manage that side of the business. And from a productivity perspective, it's that delegation, right?
Yeah, yeah. One of my commanding officers at one stage said something that kind of stuck with me. When it comes to being in more of a sort of a command, leadership, or management position, he said, "Only do what only you can do," and that's sort of stuck with me. When it comes to prioritizing, if I can recall that. Mm. And say, am I the only one that can do this? Is there somebody else that can do this?
Yeah.
And that's sort of somewhat of a guiding principle.
I like it. I think we might pull a quote card out of this. A little marketing team might be putting that one out on LinkedIn and Instagram.
Only do what only you can do. Yeah. I'll have to credit the CEO's name escapes me. It's really stuck with me. Definitely a guiding principle. And then the problem with that is I end up doing all the stuff that I can do, but it's particularly fun. Making delineation between what you're good at, what you enjoy doing, and kind of what has to be done. While I really enjoy building things and the team will vouch that I'm always in the workshop, always messing around with stuff. I'm an amateur at that. I love scripting. I love jumping in the virtual environment, doing some scripting, but I'm an amateur at it, and other people are better placed to do that. I end up doing the business development and the proposal writing and the accounting and stuff. Doing the reconciliation and stuff. So. Nice. Yeah,
it sounds like you've got a lot of you've taken a lot of knowledge, obviously, from a military background. And from a learnings perspective, is there any other books or podcasts or forms of education that you've found super useful in your time?
Yeah, I mean, I got formal training on Scrum.
Yeah,
from a Scrum Alliance, certified provider. I did the product office, product owner course.
Yeah.
The book Scrum. Yeah. Kind of the Bible on those techniques. Podcasts, Cortex is what I found to be, they, after 100 episodes, convinced me that like a to-do list, checklist, that kind of stuff actually helps. And you gotta eat your vegetables, right? You just gotta do it, and then you realize, hey, actually, no, I thought I was working, I thought I was being productive.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got a to-do list and you can smash through it and you can turn around and look and go, shit, I actually did a lot of work. So Cortex podcast is good. I mean, anything by CGP Grey, more on the entertainment side. Other books I'd recommend, I can't say I read a lot of tech literature. any management kind of theories. I'm pretty skeptical about a lot of management theory kind of stuff.
It sounds like you got a lot of that background from the military, right? Like there's a lot, I'm sure that a lot of you would have been from a leadership perspective, management of people. Like you've learned that over a number of years, right?
Yeah.
Different environment.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the military, like, you know, that's what they put on the outside of the tin. You know, join the military, you learn leadership.
Yeah.
You learn leadership principles and things like that. You get experience and, you know, you do leadership well, you do leadership badly. You get a sense of what kind of leader you are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a lot of it is personal experience. And I mean, I must preface it also, I had a pretty limited military experience, but you're getting as much experience as you can in different, you know, doing different things.
Yeah, nice. Last question. If you had to wind it back and tell a younger version of yourself a key piece of advice, anything that really sticks out?
I would say to my younger self, don't be in such a hurry for things to happen. And my younger self would no doubt ignore that advice. dealing with, you know, delay and disappointment and stuff like that, and nothing's the end of the world, right? Don't take things so seriously, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe go to university, don't slack off and be a bum. I think that would have helped, but I'm no doubt my younger self would have disregarded everything else.
Oh man, yeah, but hey, look where you are now. Maybe that might have been fast track, maybe not. Maybe you'd been a completely different world, but you're having some success at the moment. You're building the team that you've always wanted to build. Company seems to be doing well, so
this too shall pass.
Well, good, mate.
The objective of any fortress is to delay the moment of its destruction. That's my company strategy. It probably overly pessimistic. I'm probably overly conservative. Yeah. I worry, you know. But yeah, I'm trying to delay the moment of my destruction.
Because you got to enjoy, enjoy the process, right? Like if you're not enjoying the process, it's all about that end goal. Well, once you get that, you get the end goal, it's probably underwhelming, right? So if you enjoy the process along the way, I think that's the key, right? If you're enjoying building your company day to day.
Yeah, that's the way I look at it. You know, when I say this too shall pass, that's not a pessimistic comment.
No.
You know, it's like, this time will pass, so enjoy it now, enjoy the day.
Yeah, I like it, mate. Yeah. If people want to find out a little bit more about you individually or the company, best way to find contact?
I'm not really on any social media. Don't know if I'll return on LinkedIn. If you want more content, Marty content, Military History Visualized, I did a podcast with Bernard from Military History Visualized in December last year at the Tank Museum in Munster in Germany. So if you found this
interesting,
my soothing tones irresistible, or you needed a nasally voice to help you get to sleep, there's me and Bernard sitting on a panther talking about tanks. That's it for my social media presence, I'm afraid. The company appliedvirtual.net, send us a contact form. We're always hiring and not hiring, and we play games, and occasionally we get together and have a big LAN game and stuff like that, so we're always looking for people to come and play games. Yeah, and if you're interested in the kind of stuff we do, send us through a contact form on our website.
Yeah.
And just introduce yourself.
URL again?
Appliedvirtual.net.
Perfect. We'll link it up in the show notes. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again for listening to this episode. You can find all the show notes at newetechpeople.com.au. We're consistently updating the website with new show notes of new episodes, so you can also catch up with all our backlog of episodes, local tech professionals. Thanks again for listening.